Good evening, everybody. And tonight's subject is the charm of Burgundy. Silly title, possibly, but it refers to the fact that throughout Burgundy, north to south, you have these vineyards called Les Charmes. They can be red, they can be white, they cover as far down as the Beaujolais, also the Mâconnais, Côte Chalonnaise perhaps, certainly throughout the Côte de Beaune and the Côte de Nuit. And I think that there is a connecting character in all these wines, just as there is in a different style with vineyards which are called Les Crats or Les Perrières or Les Argilières. So we have future evenings looking at one or two other names. But tonight we're going to look at Charmes. We spend a nearly happy afternoon in Meursault Charmes, looking at that vineyard in some detail with our friend Dominique Lafont. But unfortunately, beautiful and sunny though it was all the time that we were setting up, once we'd actually started the filming, clouds came over, rain came down, possibly snow and sleet, and I froze to death in the north wind. So I hope I have recovered sufficiently to talk about the wines this evening. So we've done it as two white, four red, or if you prefer, two Chardonnay, one Gamay, and three Pinot. And the fact that we have got different producers and different villages means that we get a chance to talk about quite a few subjects within Burgundy, as well as Les Charmes. Now, why is it called Charmes? There are actually, I can think of at least four theories. I'm not going to reveal them all at once. We'll cover them as we go through. Perhaps I'll start with the least likely one, though, which is the sort of thing that when academics get their teeth into subjects like this, they start coming up with something which is theoretically possible, but I suspect is not the case. So it is apparently the case that words that begin with CH could easily also have been CR, and words that begin with CR in ancient French, in Gaelic, normally denote rock in some form. And of course, that's very important, the limestone rock in Burgundy. And that is where we get cra and crio and cré from. But I'm pretty sure it's not where we get charme from, because typically these are all vineyards which are based around having more clay in the soil and are less obviously rock-influenced vineyards. So I've thrown that one up and I've shot that one down, and we'll see where we get on to with the other ones. Now, I hope we've got many people joining us from all around the world, and I see that you have on the chat a list of the wines. If you don't have the wines yourselves, there's a list of the wines we're going to be tasting. And as always, keep the chat going. Let us know what you think about the wines. Let us know your comments. You can ask questions on the chat or by using the Q&A button as well. And I will endeavor, as we go through, I will endeavor to keep in tune with all that. If I'm looking away from the camera, it's because I'm regarding the chat. Lovely. So, Charmes, it's a soft, rounded, ripe, rich sounding name. And that sort of, broadly speaking, is the style of the wines that we can expect. What's also quite nice is that in both colours, the Charmes word comes across in, I can't immediately think of any Charmes, which is generic Burgundy, but you get village vineyards, premier cru vineyards, and grand cru. So in the whites, we're going to do a village and a premier cru. In the reds, after the Morgon, we're going to do village, premier cru, and then the one grand cru, which has Charmes in its name. And in fact, our two whites are adjacent vineyards. We were walking up the road between the two of them earlier. And the difference is the one in Puligny is at village level, and the one in Meursault, which we'll come on to next, is at premier cru level. That's quite a large vineyard. So what we have in glass number one is Puligny Montrachet Les Charmes from Domaine Alain Chavy. Alain, in fact, has virtually half this vineyard. He's got 1 hectare 80 out of 3.74. His brother Jean-Louis has got another half hectare, and then one or two other people have got little bits and pieces. But mostly will just put it into their village Puligny blend. I think it's only the brothers, possibly Buisson Bateau in Meursault, who specify Charmes on the label. And both Alain and Jean-Louis Chavy, they do a regular Pulini, which is made up of all their other Liodis, and then the Charme is the one that they separate out. And it is quite clearly the most interesting that they have in their cellars. Partly because it is very slightly higher on the slope. As I said, it's next to the Premier Cru Meursault Charme. And also it being at the northern end of the village, it's not close to the such watercourses as run through Pulini, either at the surface or close below, which tend to come through the middle of the village. So we have the map that Sophie has put up for us, and I'm going to leave control with her, but you should be able to see there, she's marked it with a heart where the Charme is. And the watercourse, you can see a little bit of a blue line running right down through the middle of the village, and that shows the rather lower, richer soils. So Charme, you're doing better. It's still largely clay-based, but you have plenty of little flakes of limestone within it. And then if you were to go immediately right of that heart, you would get into Meursault Charme. Okay, thanks for the map, Sophie. We'll continue now. So, Alain Chavy, he and his brother, it's one of those tricky things. I used to buy the wines from Domaine Gérard Chavy et Fils, and then they split up, and you think, what am I going to do? I'm going to work with both of them, or is one of them going to be better than the other? And I thought in the very first vintage that probably Jean-Louis was the better, but I worked with both. And then after that, I thought maybe Alain was the better. And then I'm just meaning back and tasted the 2019s, and I slightly preferred Jean-Louis, and so it goes. They do make the wines in relatively similar ways. Neither is frightened of having a decent yield, which is absolutely fine by me in Chardonnay, less keen on it in Pinot Noir. And they're neither early nor late pickers, I suppose, if I was going to call it either way. They were typically in the earlier part, but they are not sort of strong. They don't feel strongly in that way. Get the grapes in, press them, ferment, in fact, using cultured yeasts for security. And then they go to barrel with rather more bigger barrels these days. Every cuvée that Alain makes is partly in the usual 228 litre barrels, and equally it's in 400 litre barrels. So it's a mix of the two. And he has now pushed back the bottling date. So typically he will take the wines out of their barrels at the arrival of the new harvest, so that the barrels are never empty, and then they will stay refining themselves further on their fine lees in tank through to bottling in February, March. So that will be the case here. There is a little bit of reduction, as Alistair mentions, and that's sort of deliberate these days. I noticed it also in Alain's 19s. It's not too extreme. It comes within the acceptable for me, and it does bring a sense of tension rather than a sense of weight, if you like, of fruit weight. So it's quite a lime streak in the flavour profile. We're 2017 for this wine. We do vary the vintages a little bit. So this of the last years for white Burgundy, probably 14, 17 and 20 look like being the favourites, but we like 15, 19, probably 18 too in addition. So it's actually been quite a good period for white Burgundy. And the one we like less is 16, unless you didn't get frosted, in which case you could make a decent sized crop and everything went quite smoothly. So that extra reductive character probably comes from the extra months in tank, because it seems that if you are confining the wine with a little bit of fine lees and without any oxygenation, that's when some reduction comes into play. On the other hand, Alain isn't one of those people who's a fan of stirring up the lees in the wines, so this has not been stirred. It's a pure, crisp wine, I would say. What are we expecting from Pinot Noir? We're expecting a little bit of backbone, which this has. We're expecting a floral character, which the reduction is slightly masking, I'm finding, on the bouquet, but is coming through quite nicely in the aftertaste. And the aftertaste is a little bit more generous than the wine started out being. Great. Well, that's number one version of Charme. And we're going to look alongside to number two, which is a more famous wine insofar as it's Meursault Charme Premier Cru. Also from the fact that it's from Domaine des Complafonds. And it's 2016, and Dominique earlier today said that he thought that vintage is probably still too young, but it is just beginning to become ready to start tasting, he said. It's one of those vintages which, in fact, we've rather put on the back burner and haven't really been looking at for a while. So if you'd like to pop the map up there, Sophie, I will. Charme is quite a big vineyard anyway, and there we can see the heart is in the upper part of Charme, Les Charmes Dessous, and it's now gone into the lower part, Les Charmes Dessous as well. You can see there are two parts of Les Charmes Dessous, and so they've all got hearts. Above it is Perrier, next door is Genevrier, to the left was a bit of Pinot Noir Charme, and then most of it is alongside Pinot Noir Premier Cru Refaire, in fact. Now, Dominique's holding is in the upper part, on the left-hand side, so the southern side. So it's where the heart is, just above where the heart is, and just to the right of where the heart is. It's sort of a U shape. The left-hand upright of the U is 30-year-old vines, which they still refer to as the young vines. The part along the bottom are the oldest vines, middle segment in the bottom. Those are 95 years old now, though a fair number have had to be replaced since. And then the right-hand upright is the 50-year-old vines, which look magnificent. There's hardly any missing. They're really good condition. Apparently the grapes all come through, the bunches all come through at an even size. And after we had walked through the vineyard, we went back to Domaine des Complafonds and we tasted those three ages of wine from the 2020 vintage, because at the moment they're all separate in their barrels, they haven't been blended together yet, and the first wine was very nice. The second wine from the 50-year-old vines was just perfect. It had everything that Charme is about, and it had way more persistence and grip than did the 30-year-old vines. And then we tried the oldest vines, which, though they have a backbone almost reminiscent of Pinot Noir, were slightly less well balanced overall. It wasn't the natural expression of Charme which the 50-year-old vines had given us. And this really was, in that 2020 iteration, a perfect example of a wine which has got weight and depth, a certain roundness that is balanced and not too sloppy, not clumsily weighty, but just with depth and still with good grip. 2016, why did we dare show this vintage, which can be my least favorite in recent years? The answer is that everything depended on whether you got frosted, and that's because of why you got frosted. What happened that year, it was an April frost, and it wasn't a frost just caused by lowering of temperatures. It was a frost caused by a drop in temperature when the vines were humid, and then the early morning sun coming up and grilling through the little layer of ice, grilling the buds. But it didn't happen if particular vineyards were covered by a cloud cover. And it so happened that the village parts of Meursault and the Premier Crus of Pinot Noir, there was no cloud cover, and they got really savage. And the Grand Crus even worse, Morrochet almost totally. But Meursault Charme, Perrier, Genevrier, sort of the big three, there was this fine little cloud sitting over the top, and they didn't get frosted, and they made a full crop. And as a result, you could pick it when all the grapes were ready together, whereas in the frosted areas, you tended to get two generations. The first generation which by the time you picked was probably overripe because you had to wait for the second generation, which was underripe. So you ended up with this sort of sweet and sour aspect in a lot of the 2016s, which is why I'm not a huge fan of the vintage in general. But as I say, if you avoided that, and this would have been a proper yield of 50, 55 hectolitres a hectare, whereas next door in Lafon's Porozo, he made 5 hectolitres a hectare because there wasn't the cloud cover there. So Dominique keeps the wine for the first year in barrel, about a third new oak, and then it stays down and it gets racked at that point, stays down in the deep, cool cellars, which Meursault have and Puligny doesn't have. And it goes back into barrel, but with older wood. So there's probably no new wood at all in the second year. But merely the fact of having a minimum of 18 months, anything up to 20 months in wood, does tend to give a nice sort of solid oak background without, I hope, the oak dominating the wine too much. I hope you're all still there. I lost you briefly on my own screen, but I hope you're still there on the main screen. Just going to taste the wine now. Now we see charm proper. There's a little yellowness in the fruit because it's properly ripe, but it's not exaggerated. You still got the correct amount of acidity, freshness at the back. But there is an overall sweetness, and he's too good a winemaker for it to be a softness, but there is a rounded character to this, which to me is the epitome of charm. And there's a, frankly, there's a significantly longer aftertaste in this wine. You've disappeared again from my home screen, but I'm sure you're there on the main screen. It's my home screen which allows me to catch up on the chat, so I may be missing that from time to time if we keep getting these little breaks in the service. I hope not for too much. Okay, I don't know what your comments may be. Alice has asked if 2016 was as difficult for reds as whites. Actually, it wasn't. They suffered maybe as much, but they didn't seem to have this two-generation effect. And the quality of the reds, I am much more excited by in 2016 than those whites which suffered from the frost. Good. So, someone is not having a good experience on the on the bouquet. Arno, I think, is not having a good experience on the bouquet. Unfortunately, on the charm, Meursault charm from Lafon, but mine is exactly what it ought to be. So, maybe some variation going on. Now, other possibilities for white charm vineyards. There isn't a charm, I don't think, in Chassagne-Maraîchère, but there is next door in Santenay. And in fact, of all the Santenay village vineyards, charm is one where you frequently will see white wines. And there's not one in Saint-Aubin either. I don't really see it in Saint-Aubin. Saint-Aubin is higher up, higher in altitude. It's much more of a firmly limestone appellation on the whole. And that actually brings me to the next point about charm, is that almost all the vineyards are on the same contour level, around about 240 meters above sea level. Now, remembering that the premier crus go up to 300 and exceptionally up to just touching on 400 meters above sea level, we are on the whole on the lower lying land with a broader clay base to the vineyards. So you're never straight on the rock in Charme. Maybe I should mention possible explanation number two for Charme, which is that it is a corruption of the word chaume. And you do occasionally have les chaumes. You have Vosne-Romanée les chaumes, for example. You have Chassagne-Maraîchère les chaumes and les chaumes. And these theoretically, that comes from something which could have been a hay field or was en friche in French, was not being cultivated. The vineyards often quite close to the village itself, which then people turned into vineyards, but they remembered what they'd been before and went on using the name Chaume. And you can see it's not that difficult to jump from Chaume to Charme, particularly if Charme gives you a little bit more friendly and attractive a character to it. So we don't know. That is definitely a possible explanation. Explanations 3 and 4 to come later on if you stay on channel. Great. So my Zoom has died again. I will endeavor to get it back, but bear with me if we don't. From whites, we go on to reds, which will change glass. 4 to look at, 3 Pinots, 1 Gamay. Glad to get down to Beaujolais. I've been missing it. I've been drinking a little bit in the evenings, but it's been too long since I actually visited the region. Overdue. And I suppose my original favorite village would have been Moulin-Vent for its wines of great power and depth and some tannins. And then I had my flirtation with Fleury for its lovely floral character and cheerfulness and brightness of color and immediately attractive fruit. But also for a long time, I've liked Morgon, which after Moulin-Vent is probably the most tannin-based of the Beaujolais crus, and also the one that goes more towards Pinot Noir as it ages, Sapinot, as they say. Now, the most famous vineyard or sector of Morgon is Côte de Pie, which is a volcanic rock that stands up just south of the small village of, well, there are two villages, Morgon and Villiers-Morgon. And it's very obvious, very prominent, steep slopes. And that is the particular sector that most often gets put as a separate bottling. So, however, it's not Charme, but there is just a little bit below it, a little bit set further back, a bit to the west, and on the southern edge, you get a vineyard called Charme, right by a hamlet called Grange Cochard, and used to be a Chateau Grange Cochard, which was owned, they've just sold up, in fact, and moved out. But my friends, James and Sarah, who come from St. Albans and James decided to give up being an accountant in St. Albans and become a vigneron in Morgon. And he made a lovely Charme. But here we have a different version. We have from Jean Foyard, made by the son David Foyard. And he actually worked in Burgundy. He did a long internship with Prieuré Roch, who are the people who in the Côte d'Or in particular have really explored to the full natural way of making wines. And that in any case was the Foyard idea, because he is one of the handful of domains who are the disciples, if you like, of Jules Jouvet, and make the wines in as natural a style as possible. And we have got their Charme. And what's delightful is he puts on the label the word eponyme, eponymous Charme. So it could have been the word epitome as well, if such a thing exists in French. I'm sure it does. But that would have been the other option. So I now have my screen back. So I'm going to check on the chat as we go along and see how we're all doing. So let's have a look at it. I love that purple color, really vigorous, friendly stuff. Oh, dear me. And okay, we're not going to confuse that with Pinot Noir in its youth. But that has come absolutely sailing out of the stocks. It's a 2018. You know, so that's one of the very early warm vintages. I find it personally, I find it quite different from 2015, which one might assume it to be similar to. But the 2015s I found a little bit overdone, a little bit too rich and cooked. And I found that the heat of the vintage dominated the wines. And I don't know technically why, but 2018, I find them much fresher. Yes, it's a ripe fruit profile, but the wines are not too heavy, not too weighty. And I've had already a lot of pleasure out of 2018 Beaujolais. I haven't got around to buying as many as I ought to have done for myself, but it's probably still time. Smell that perfume. It's absolutely gorgeous. Very lively on the palate. Tannins, yes, acidity too. White pepper and spice, because this will be a whole bunch style, as is much more typical in the Beaujolais. Mm. Yes, and a length of flavor too. Now, compare that to his Côte du Pi. That's going to be a more angular wine. It's probably going to be more tannic, maybe more powerful. This wine has got the right structural elements, but you're left with an impression of something rounder and indeed charming in the mouth, at least I am. So I think that it does live up to its name in that respect. Ah, Arno is loving the Morgon and says we ought to have more Beaujolais tastings. Well, we shall. We certainly shall. Yep. And we need to do some thematic ones. We can maybe do ones, cover the different crews and give each crew a full tasting of its own. My excellent cameraman comes from Lyon, so I'm sure he'll be very happy to do some work in the Beaujolais. So clearly it is Beaujolais, clearly it's in the modern style, clearly from a fine, modern, warmer vintage, but it's got a beautiful freshness to it and it's got the grace of charm. That's going to bring us slowly onto wine number four, and coincidence, not planned, but it's from Thibaut Ligier-Belair, who of course has Beaujolais plantings as well. He has his Moulin Vent estate, and he's also doing a wonderful thing. He had one or two other vineyards that came with it, and it didn't quite make sense for him in how he viewed what he wanted to do with all the Moulin Vent ideas. So he started a company called Jeune Pousse, or Young Shoots, and basically he's installing a young couple for 2 to 3 years, and then they'll move on and another young couple will come in. And he's installed them to give them the buildings and let them take on the vines, and they will make vines from the other appellations which aren't Moulin Vent. Good, good, good. I will maybe swap glasses to this one. So Arno wants to know what I make of Thibaut's Moulin Vents. I was really, really impressed right from year one. They have, in fact, once when tasting his Burgundy wines in the cellar with Thibaut, I think we even got as far as the Richebourg, and I was chatting away about it, and Thibaut was looking at me, and he said, "Do you know what, Jasper? I think you prefer my Moulin Vent to my Burgundy." And for the first couple of years, that was probably true. After then, I think, particularly with the move to the new cellar in the Rue Saint-Georges, I think Thibaut's Burgundies have really taken a big step forwards. And his Moulin Vent, I've stopped drinking them before they're about 10 years old, currently drinking 2010 and 2011, and I've got some 2009 still waiting in the wings because they are such intense wines that they ought to be kept. He makes lots of single vineyard ones, but he doesn't have anything called Charme. Right, but he does in Rue Saint-Georges, and it is actually the baby Charme. It's the Charmotte, if we could have a look at the map. Anything O-T in masculine or O-T-T-E in feminine, it just means the little version of in Burgundy speak. So there you've got the map, and you will see just to the right or north of the village in Rue Saint-Georges, you will see La Charmotte, and Sophie's heart will appear on it. There you go. Perfect. So it's just under the Premier Cruz, fairly close to the village. It's a flattish soil. We are, again, at more or less the same height above sea level as all the others. We've again got the fairly full covering of clay, but not just solid clay to stomp around in and clog your shoes up. There are always some limestone chips in all these vineyards. It's more varied in the Morgon version because there it's not limestone chips, it's volcanic chips, and actually a bit of quartz as well gets mixed in with the clay in the Charm there. I was quite keen on showing also a Puy-Frissé Le Charme. There's only one of those, which is in the village of Vergisson, down below the church of Vergisson, but we didn't find a sample of that. Good. So now this wine, partly coming after the Morgon, is noticeably paler in colour. And it's actually become a little bit more evolved. And I thought of a second reason for that, says he, checking the sheet. It's because we switched vintages. We've gone from 2018 to 2014. So 2014, a vintage highly sung in white, good in red, but not quite in the top category. And maybe just beginning to get ready to take a look at. It'll be interesting to see. I haven't smelt it or tasted it so far. It's often the question of 2014s to see whether the acidity has started to meld in with the fruit of the wine. Yum. We've already got some slightly secondary notes here. Clean and pure, not farmyard stuff, but we're beginning to move away from that primary fruit that we kicked off with into something which is exploring a greater range and subtlety of flavours. So Thibaut has got 9 ouvres of this, 0.39 of a hectare, which is enough that you can therefore make in a good year, maybe seven barrels, and even in a small year, 3, 4, 5 barrels. So that's enough that you can do a decent job with it. It's one of his original vineyards when he started, took back family domain in 2002. He began with the Richebourg, then Nuit Saint-Georges, Les Saint-Georges, the Clos Vougeot, a village Vaune, Auréas, and the Nuit Saint-Georges, Charmotte. Since then, he's built it up considerably. I'm enjoying going back. It's gentle, it's low key, but it's really quite attractive, a bouquet. Trying to check in with what's going on. Yes, David's had a bottle of Thibaut's Aligoté. I think we've used that. I think we did use that in the Aligoté Zoom. And every time I get the chance to taste it and drink it, I really love that wine. He's a great character, and I think we will probably do a Thibaut Meet the Winemaker Zoom at some point. And we'll do that in his winery, where you can see all the new gadgets he's surrounded himself with. And they're not gadgets for the sake of gadgets. They've all been carefully thought out, like the shape of his fermenting tanks, which round ones take up much too much room. Square ones give you sharp corners, which don't allow the wine to circulate in the ideal way inside. So he's had designed for him, built for him, square ones with rounded corners. So that's the sort of detail that Thibaut goes into. The other thing, and whether that was true as long ago as 2014, it may well have been, is for his barrels, he takes over the, the cooperage of the Tonnellerie de Mercure for 2 days, and says, okay, these 2 days are just consecrated to making my barrels. And with their team, he goes there. It's done after the harvest, so he already has an idea of what wines he's got. He knows exactly what toast and which forest and which this and which that sort of grain he wants for each wine. And he gets all the barrels made up to his specifications for the new vintage. And probably there's nobody else doing that. He also goes out and he buys the wood as well from the trees. So he is, the French would say polyvalent, but we'd say a man of all talents. a lighter version of Charm. And actually, for me, I think we're beginning to get still a little bit of acidity behind, which is not atypical of 2014 vintage. But I think we're getting into a nice, and I've also served these wines for myself quite cold, which I often do for tasting samples as opposed to drinking at dinner. I think that's pretty close to being ready to start. Good. Any more questions? I think we might have. My mouse is sliding. I have the sliding mouse. Yeah. Good, good. Looks, I don't know, something's in the air tonight. It must be the wrong sort of day in the biodynamic calendar, but it seems as though several people are having connection problems and are slipping in and out. And great to see several of you making regular comments, but anybody else who's listening in, please don't be frightened to, even if it's the first time, but put up a comment and we'll try and bring that into the thread of the discussion tonight. Maybe I should introduce the third possible reason for Charm being called Charm, which is that it's to do with trees, and that Charm or Charmy in French are hornbeam trees, such as you might easily see close to a village. And you might also see it on ground that's not too steep and has a little bit of topsoil for them to get established in. So maybe in each case, these were areas in which you had quite a lot of hornbeam, which is sort of a baby beech almost. Maybe that was the case. It would surprise me a little bit if every village had got its own little sort of hornbeam plantation just outside city limits, but it's certainly not impossible. Brings us on to wine number four, Burgundy number four, plus the Beaujolais. And we've gone back to a much deeper, denser color. No surprise, it's only 1 year younger, but it's 2015. So we're up in the power zone again. So this is made by our very good friend, Ghislaine Barthaud, who shares the winery with Louis Boyau, but they do make their wines not actually very differently, but they each are responsible for their own wines until 2019 when their son Clément takes over. And we've got Hearts Galore going right in the middle of the vineyard. Guess what? It's again at the sort of at the foot of the slope. Actually, this Charm is a mini plateau. And if you look at that screen, left-hand heart to the left of there is Les Audouins and Les Amoureuses. And actually, the slope goes up a little bit from there. But whether you are in the village vineyards just below, Condamine, or to the right where you have La Plante, or up above where you go into Fesselot, on all those other sides, you actually are dropping down away from Charm. So it's riding on its little plateau. It's an area that I thought was perhaps going to be suffering with global warming on the theory that quality was going to go further up the hill towards Les Croix and Les Fuets. But actually, Charm, again, with that extra topsoil, a little bit more depth to it, it does retain the humidity all right. And as a result, it's not such a bad place to be if the years are very dry. So 2019 Charm came through quite well. So here we are. So, Ghislaine and Louis as well have moved to a much, much earlier picking style. From 2009 was the year that they moved them this way, when they picked several days before anybody else. They picked even a couple of days before they were planning to, so they were maybe a full week before other people, and they still felt they might have picked too late. So there are so many different ways of judging the ripeness for picking. And some people want to wait till every possible component of the grape is ripe, but then these days that risks getting you up to the 15.5 degrees, which we don't want. and they'd rather keep a little bit of freshness. It can make the wines a tiny bit aggressive in their youth. They age extremely well. They're not frightened of punching down as well as pumping over in the vinification. So that again gives you a bit of structure. You always get good colors. You always get intensity. You always get a good structure in the wines of Ghislaine Bateau and now, as I say, Clément. But they'll age really well. So this is 2015. I'm enjoying the aromatics. It's still totally young, showing the ripeness of the vintage, in that you're in quite dark, ripe cherry, ripe dark cherry fruit. Not quite black cherry, but definitely in the darker fruit spectrum. Still in its youth, strong acidity behind and some tannins. Natural acidity, partly connected to the relatively early picking here. But that's all part of defining the structure which will make a wine to age. Now, there's a debate about whether one should make wines to age. On the whole, I believe it's a good thing, because on the whole, I think if your wine ages slowly to reach its apogee, it actually reaches a higher apogee than if everything happens quickly. Also in the past, whether it'll be, it's perhaps still true, is that you could just about afford to buy the wine when it was young, as long as you don't think about the cost of money. 15 years later, when you start to drink the wine, it suddenly looks dirt cheap compared to what that same wine and the brand new vintage is costing. That is still true at the moment when you look at what 19s and 20s, well, we don't know about 20s yet, but 18s and 19s are costing compared to what wines 10 years earlier were costing. Then it's good to have some wines in your cellar which go back quite a long way. Yes, David's saying, us older blokes don't want to be passing them on to the kids. David, you're not that much older than I am, if at all, and so you can still be buying wines for 20, 25 years' time, because you'll want something when you've got your feet up in front of the fire, got your slippers on, hanky on your head, whatever in the summer. You'll be wanting a nice glass of wine alongside. So much vigor in this wine. Really interesting to contrast the 2014 from Thibault, 2015 from Ghislaine. But remembering, of course, that this is Premier Cru, and with the exception of Amoureuse that we forget about because we think of it as a Grand Cru, on the whole, for most of the time, Charme has probably been regarded as the number one Premier Cru in Chambord. Bateau is not a particularly big holder of volume here. They've only got a quarter of a hectare. So you've got Amyot, Cervelle, Clerget have a hectare or plus. François Berthaud, Hulot-Bayet, Ponceau, the Primo-Rions have all got reasonable holdings as well. And then after that comes Gisine Bateau and Gérard Munieret, whose wines are looking very good these days. Very good tension and structure at the back. But I still feel there is a wealth of fruit right across the main body, which is coherent with what we've been saying about Charme. Okay. Clear my glass. And now we come to, I was going to say, Jerry Rafferty, that wouldn't be kind, but Gérard Raffet. So this is a domain, it comes into the category of domains which are adored by the people who know the wines and love them, and under the radar otherwise. I first knew it at the very first edition of the thing called the Grand Jour de Bourgogne, which should be going on this week, but with COVID restrictions, it's not really happening. There was a tasting, I think on the Thursday of that week, when we all went to the Clos Vougeot, and down in the cellars, actually it wasn't the Clos Vougeot, it was in the area, but it was the cellars of the Château de Gilly. There was a tasting of lots of different 1988 Clovisos. And I thought, right, I've identified my favorite. And I called him up afterwards. It was Jean Raffet, father of Gérard, and said, can I make an appointment for tomorrow morning? And he said, yeah, sure, I'll come by at 9. And I turned up at 9, and there were 15 other people who'd all been at the tasting the night before, all of whom thought it was the best wine. And so we all tasted together. And I did manage to get some for the UK, but actually that wine never really quite developed as well as I'd hoped. But it was very, very impressive first up. I think it might have been, he might have been an early adept at the sort of cool pre-maceration, which makes the wine really cheerful and glossy up front. Never quite developed the heart. Anyway, in 2002, I think his son Gérard took over. Don't think it was an easy transition from father to son. And Gérard is still the man in charge, but a lot of the work is being done by his daughter Marion, who, as well as, from what I hear, is a very gifted worker, both vineyards and in the cellar. She's also a judo black belt, so woe betide anybody who comes along and wants to challenge pricing or allocations or doesn't like the wine. You might get a dusty answer. So the domain is based up in Meaux-Saint-Denis, but with a new winery just down below the village. And the vintage we have is 2012, and I'm happy to say that, like the 2014, it is beginning to take on some secondary characteristics. Let's have a look. We have our map of Gevrey Chambertin, and there is Charme Chambertin, a heart on that side. You can do a heart over on the, yes, you're getting excited, Sophie. Scattering the hearts, and you could also even put some next door to the left, because the left is Mazoyer Chambertin, which may also be sold as Charme Chambertin. There we go, that next bit of purple. That can have just a single heart as well. Thank you. No, scattering more. Now, they are two different vineyards. You're allowed to sell Mazoyer as Charme, and together they make nearly 31 hectares, but 18 and a half of that is Mazoyer, just over 12 is pure Charme. And I'm always a little bit sad that people don't choose to use the name Mazoyer. It's less well known. There are, I think, two people who use Charme Chambertin au Mazoyer, and there are a handful, three or four, Perumino, Dugapi, Topino, Mam, who have enough of both Charme and Mazoyer to make separate bottlings. Otherwise, most people call it Charme. In the case of Raffet, they have both Charme and Mazoyer, but I have a feeling that they sell the Mazoyer off, and the wine that they make is purely from the Charme side. And the Charme part does really categorize, or characterize, I should say, what we have been saying about Charme. And Mazoyer doesn't. Mazoyer is a lighter colored soil. It's a stonier soil. The wines are a little bit more, how would I say, a little bit more angular, a bit more mineral. They're actually more Meaux-Saint-Denis than they are Gevrey Chambertin. Whereas Charme, we are normally into the classics, into that glorious, richer, softer bench of fruit. Some people are a little bit down on Charme, partly because bits of Mazoyer go down to the main road, as you can see on the map. Maybe we could lose the hearts now. We'll keep the map for a second, but we'll lose the hearts because they're covering up everything. But you can see there, Mazoyer goes down to the main road. In fact, there's a reason for that. If you look up above there, go up through Le Troussier Chambertin, you'll see what the contour lines are doing. And you'll see they're heading up back into the slope. And that's because there is a combe in French, there, which is funneling, the combe grisard, which is funneling down cooler air. And also, at some time, it would have been a watercourse, and it has changed the geology. And you've got the geology which makes up that bench of Grand Crus is being spread further down the slope. So you can just about make a justification. But real Charme is not so far down and can be most glorious. So names like Joseph Roty and Denis Bachelet, plus some of the famous all-round players, the Dujecs of this world. Raffet is a domain that I've never worked with in my commercial life, so I'm a little bit less familiar with. So this will be fun for me to taste the wine here tonight. And of course, Alistair mentions you do have Rousseau as well. But... So. These are, we haven't really been talking about it all the way through. The Morgon was a whole bunch. The Nuit Saint-Georges Chamot would have been a mix, but I didn't pick up too much of the whole bunch style. Justin Bateau is all destemmed, and this is all destemmed. So 2012, a year that suffered a bit from hail in the Côte de Beaune, not so in the Côte de Nuit, so it's actually come out very well in the Côte de Nuit. But it's one that's a bit under the radar because people don't consider it amongst the top vintages, but it's delivering lots of nice wines. And a bit like 2006, which I had a bottle of Gevrey Chambertin 2006 last night, a vintage that we've a bit forgotten about, but they're really nice wines and they're coming into their own. Little bit of acidity in the wine, and then this burst of raspberry fruit, which I'm enjoying quite a lot. A little bit of sweetness then to follow through, sweetness and roundness to finish off the wine on the palate. Getting those secondaries, but they're very clean. They're not in the sort of the bacterial mode. But you are starting to walk gently down the garden path and thinking about heading towards the forest, where in another 5 or 10 years you'll begin to find the forest floor in this wine. But we're not there yet. And there's an underlying vigorous red fruit too behind. So that brings us through to our fourth possible definition of charme, which is my definition. And I suspect it doesn't quite work either. But I just wonder if people didn't start attributing this name Charme to those sections of the vineyard which they thought gave wines of immense charm. Because it's rare in any of these villages that you can find a wine more potentially charming than that which comes from the vineyard called Les Charmes. It's true that throughout this range, it will depend a little bit on who the grower is, how they've made it, what the vintage is. But nonetheless, there has been this little bench of graceful sweetness, throat caressing, charm charisma to all the wines throughout. So that's my theory. It doesn't really quite hold true because in the long distant times when most of these vineyards would have got their names, people didn't make separate bottlings of individual sites. So that slightly works against my theory. But whether it is Chaume, whether it is charm as in hornbeam, or whether it's charm as in the charmingness of the wine, I don't know. The only theory I don't believe in is the sort of professional's theory that it is connected to the rock, because I just don't see it for where these vineyards are based. I did a tasting for Bourgogne Aujourd'hui magazine a while back. I proposed the idea and they jumped at it, in which I said, let's look at all the charme together. And they got together 30 or 40 samples and we tasted them blind. So because we were sort of giving them scores for and see which producers came out well. But frankly, every one of them had an element of the charme characteristic, apart from one, which was a Marsannay vineyard called La Charme au Prêtre, which probably means the charm of the priests and is more to do with priestly charm than the vineyard charm. And that was a much more angular wine than any of the others that went by. In fact, if you talk to Sylvain Patay, he says it doesn't work in red, it's better off in white. Well, I have pretty much talked us through what I had to say about this. Okay, gosh, we've had an interesting question from Philip, who wants to know about my smelling technique. He's saying that you take small, I do indeed. There's no harm in taking one longer one as well, but I often take small little sniffs too. My old business partner used to do something which annoyed me immensely, but in fact it worked for him. He'd hold the glass steadily and he would pass his nose slowly across the top and back the other way. It doesn't really matter. In an early television program, Genesis Robinson, she filmed us when we were practicing the MW, and she had different pictures of people going, you know, the standard. I was down as doing the single oblique nostril approach. And one unfortunate character who never passed was caught doing that with his wine, putting it up to his ear. There are various different ways of doing it. Sophie has given us the... So please vote, those of you who've got the wines, for your two favorite wines. I am going to do that as well. I think I'm allowed to. Zap, zap. Looks as though... Have we only done one wine tonight, Sophie? I think we have only done one wine, because when I put my... marker on a wine, the other one disappears. So I fear you may only have one vote rather than two. I'm going to submit mine, and if you would like to submit yours, then if everybody's done that, take it away. And let's have the answers. Yes, it looks as though we could only pick one between us. And we have 6% for Alain Chevy's Charme. We have 11% jointly for Lafon's Meursault Charme and the Morgon, which had I had two votes, I would have voted for both of those. As it is, I voted for the Morgon. And we then have 17% for Thibault Lichibelaer and joint winners, 28%. You snobs, you've gone for the two most expensive red wines. Chambon Musnier Premier Cru Les Charmes from Ghislaine Bateau and the Charme Champeter from Raffet. Frankly, I enjoyed all the wines, so there are many I could have voted for. If I'd had two, maybe one would have gone for the wine that did best in its category and the wine that was the best wine overall. Now, we have a magical thing happening on Thursday this week, but alas, the time has changed. Because we're doing it at lunchtime in the UK. The reason is that we're actually doing this in alliance with the importers in Hong Kong and Singapore. And we've got whole roomfuls of people. They're now allowed to, they're slightly unlocked down, they can gather. And so we are doing, we will be based at Domaine Eugénie in Vosne-Romanée. And I will be doing it with both Frédéric Angerer, who's the overall boss of all the Artemis Domaine's wineries, Chateau Latour, Clos de Tar now, Chateau Grillet, and also in California, and also Michel Mallard, who is the winemaker, technical director at Domaine Eugénie. So that's what's next. And then after that, I have a busy schedule of weekly tastings and other programs designed to fit on 67 Pall Mall television, coming your way very soon. So I hope you've enjoyed this evening. Sounds as though people have been having fun on the chat. I'm going to pour myself another little glass of the Morgon after I finish the Charme Champeter. Just like to say thank you to Sophie behind the scenes, and thank you all for your support for 67 Pall Mall and for our evening Zooms, and hope to see you Thursday lunchtime at Domaine Eugénie. Thanks. Bye-bye.